I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is actor and producer Wendell Pierce. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Wendell Pierce. Wendell Pierce is a Juilliard-trained actor whose baritone voice and infectious charisma made his role as Baltimore Detective Bunk Moreland on David Simon's The Wire an instant classic. His portrayal of the trombone-playing journeyman New Orleans musician Antoine Baptiste in Simon's Tremé, all about post-Katrina New Orleans, secured his place in television history. Wendell Pierce helped mount and starred in a now legendary production of Waiting for Godot, staged in two of New Orleans' neighborhoods hardest hit by Katrina. And in doing so, he discovered the redemptive, healing power of art. Wendell Pierce is here tonight with his new book, The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. Before we meet him, let's take a look at Wendell Pierce in The Wire and Tremé.
I was a few years ahead of you at Edmondson, but I know you remember the neighborhood, how it was. My father had me on the straight. But like any young man, I wanted to be hard, too. So I would turn up at all the house parties where the tough boys hung. They knew I wasn't one of them. Them hard cases would come up to me and say, "Go home, school boy, you don't belong here." Didn't realize at the time what they were doing for me. Rough as that neighborhood could be, we had us a community. Nobody, no victim who didn't matter. And now all we got is bodies.
Let me get some of that. All right, hold on, me and you. I need your love so badly. I love you, oh, so madly. But I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you.
Blow your horn, man.
Man, I'm all blowed out, man. I like what y'all doing, though. I like that.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
it. Thank you.
I am not a real musician. I just played one on TV.
Actually, I think NPR once called you something like the best fake trombone player in the country. Yeah. How well do you play the trombone?
I actually learned for the show. And like every little boy in New Orleans, you picked up the trumpet at least for a week, which I did in sixth grade. But I learned for the show. I played everything on the show. I learned every song. I learned every solo. But I sounded like a fifth grader. And so right off camera, they had Stafford Agee of the Rebirth Brass Band, who played along with me.
Well, you certainly learned.
And they recorded him. Yeah,
so. You learned how to carry the horn.
Oh, yeah.
Because the way you carried that horn around the streets.
And we were actually supposed to answer the question of why I was carrying my horn like that around the streets. But there was actually a musician in New Orleans, a very famous musician to this day, who was a part of the resurgence of the brass band movement in the 80s, a guy named Wolf. Wolf was a little down on his luck, and he didn't have a case, and he used to carry his horn around like that, just slip it over his, break it apart and slip it over his arm and walk around. Banged it all up and all, but he still sounded good.
Well, a lot of the characters on Treme were based on real people, and we're going to get to that, and we're going to get to The Wire, I promise. But I want to start with Pontchartrain Park.
Yes.
Where you grew up, where you spent your childhood. That place was, you called it a Negro Levittown, and it exemplified the American dream. And for those people who don't know what Levittown is, talk about that and how it was the American dream for your family.
It was a bucolic neighborhood. It was like, it grew out of something really violent and ugly. You know, segregation in New Orleans. You could not buy a house anywhere. You were segregated out of any of the new post-World War II neighborhoods that were coming up. Out of something ugly, we made something beautiful. My parents' generation bought these homes, and it was a place where working-class and middle-class African-Americans could raise their families. And out of it, became an incubator for black talent. Our first black mayor, Dutch Morial, came out of it. His son, Mark Morial, who was also mayor, now the president of the National Urban League. Lisa Jackson, I grew up with her, the EPA director in the Obama administration. Terrence Blanchard, who's a Grammy Award-winning jazz composer and player, and I think I put myself in that in that group
yeah,
now.
Yeah, you should. So that
was Pontchartrain Park. It was like a black Mayberry.
So that's where you grew up, mm-hmm. And so much of what we learn about you and your life and your career in this book comes back to your family.
Yes.
You have such a strong family, in particular your mother,
yes.
T. So talk a little bit about how that's the foundation of who you are and what family means to you, because it comes across in every chapter.
The reason I wrote this book, it's a snapshot. It's not a full memoir. I like to call it a snapshot of this particular time. I learned in our darkest hour what was the most important things to me. My art, it was an awakening. The legacy of culture in New Orleans, it was an epiphany, a reminder. And then the legacy of my family. Mm-hmm. What my parents' generation had done to build this community where so many people got their foundation and were able to move on and have successful lives and have the foundation of a beautiful home life and community. And then just the legacy of my family that goes all the way back for generations in South Louisiana. My mother was a school teacher. My father was a laborer. He was actually a photographer, studied in New York. But ultimately, he was a studio photographer. You used to have to go to a studio to get your picture taken. All of a sudden, they gave you Instamatics, and then my father's whole generation of photographers, they went out of business. My mother was a school teacher for like 40 years. Mm. And she, along with my father, just instilled in us a love of family, a love of our community, and an understanding from all the trials and tribulations that they had gone through, understanding that they are those who don't have our best interest at heart. And my grandfather had a saying, Kant died 3 days before the creation of the world, so don't ever tell me you can't do something. Mm-hmm. And that was the basis of what our family was built on. You know?
So you had a little exposure to art, Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee on the radio,
yes.
The Peter and the Wolf thing, but there you are, you're sitting in high school, you're thinking about trying out for the football team, and something happens.
Well, I was on the football team,
oh, you were
hold
on
now.
Oh.
I wasn't trying out, I made it.
You made it. All right.
I didn't play or nothing like that. But, you know.
And then something happened that sent you to the New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts.
Yes.
And that was a real turning point. And in fact, wasn't Wynton Marsalis there as well?
Yes.
How did that happen?
I went to a high school, a college preparatory high school called Benjamin Franklin High School, a performing arts high school where you went half the day. it took the place of your elective. So I had the best of both worlds. I had a great academic, college preparatory, high school, and then I would have a half-hour lunch and catch a bus and then go to New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. 2 years ahead of me was Wynton Marsalis. Ahead of him was Branford Marsalis. A year ahead of me was Terrence Blanchard. Donald Harrison was there. All these kids came behind me, like Nicholas Payton, and there's this actor kid. I spoke to him in school, Anthony Mackie. There's a kid now. He has a TV gig, John Batiste, with Stephen Colbert. And someone's going to write a book about the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, because out of that school, so many talented people came in New Orleans. And that's when I really discovered that I was not alone in my love for the arts. I had done a play when I was in sixth grade and was interested in it. And then I went there and realized that this was my calling. It was the thing that I loved to do. It was my vocation. And they taught me that I was not alone, that if you were serious about it, they taught me that it was a lifestyle. It's not just something incidental that you do. This is something that you should pursue in a way that you pursue all callings, vocations. You should be a student of your craft. And I became a student of my craft. My goal was to hopefully make my vocation my occupation, the thing that I'm called to do, the thing that I earn my living at. I accept the fact that one day it will not be my occupation, the thing that I earn my living at, but it will always be my vocation. I'll be a garbage man, come home, take a shower, and go to the community theater and do a play.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
There's the
five stages of an actor's career. We all know. Who is Wendell Pierce? Get me Wendell Pierce. Get me someone like Wendell Pierce. Get me a younger Wendell Pierce. And then the fifth stage is, who is Wendell Pierce? That's when you see me, you know, riding the guard in the chicken suit saying, boy, I was bunk on the wire.
So talk about honing your craft. You did it at one of the best places in the country, if not the world, which is Juilliard.
Yes.
You're 18 years old. You get to New York. Did that just blow your mind?
New York, it was someplace I always wanted to go. I knew I wanted to go and study there. I got into University of Chicago and Sarah Lawrence and academically, Brandeis.
Uh-huh.
I was about to get into Brandeis. I don't want to lie. Now, hold on. I don't think I got the letter. But then I got into Juilliard, and I said, this is a rare opportunity. So I went to Juilliard, and Juilliard was really where it just all came together. I knew I was in a place that was going to afford me the opportunity to pursue it as a career. It gave me the best opportunity. Going to Juilliard for an actor is like playing basketball at Duke. So even if you sit on the bench, they know who you are even before you get out of school. And so you look at the people who have come out of Juilliard. Most people only think of it as a music school, but going all the way back to the first class of Kevin Klein and Patti LuPone and David Ogden Stiers and Stephen Henderson and Robin Williams went there, and you know, and Elizabeth McGovern, and the list goes on and on. Andre Brower and Ving Rhames and Laura Linney and Wendell Pierce. And
So you're in New York. You get classically trained at Juilliard. And then your first big break in 1991 was in August Wilson's The Piano Lesson.
Yes.
So doesn't get much better than that.
I'll never forget. It's a little footnote in theater history that I actually took over for Charles Dutton. And they used to make fun of me. And they were like, you look like Boy Willie's little brother. But I was his understudy, and then I took over the role for the last couple of months. But to work with Lord Richards, who was the director of the original production of Raisin in the Sun, he actually discovered August Wilson. He really taught August Wilson, who was a poet at heart and a great playwright, you know, that you can't have a character leave over here and then in the next scene come right back in here, you know, or later in the same scene. But they were a great collaborative team, and I was so nervous when I was auditioning for that role. And I remember speaking of family and legacy, my grandmother had just passed, and the whole play is about the legacy of family, Papa Boy Charles and Mama Ola, separated in slavery, where he carved the members of his family on this piano in the master's house so that he would have his family around him who had been sold away from him. And Boy Willie in the play goes back. Boy Willie, like his father, said, "We're going to steal that piano out of that house. That's our family. That's our legacy." And so when I was auditioning for the play, my grandmother had just died. And I remember said, "Lloyd, just one second." And I turned and I touched the piano. I said, my grandmother, we called her Mamo. And I said, "Mamo, this is for you. If I am to get this, it is because of you. So do this with me." And then I did the audition and I got the role. Yeah, so
wow.
I remember that.
So I'm going to jump us forward again because we're going to come to David Simon and The Wire. He appears throughout your book because, of course, he's part of The Wire. He's part of Tremé. He became very involved in New Orleans pre- and post-Katrina. David Simon was a Baltimore police reporter, and he has become one of our most profound artistic voices on race. I mean, you see him on panels now with Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's all over the place. So when you first met him and he started
talking... Which he gets upset about, he's like, "Oh, man."
Does he?
Yeah. He feels a little uncomfortable about it. He says it's really not about race. It's about the dysfunction of our communities, you know, which unfortunately disproportionately affects people of color more than anything. And but he becomes a great... he holds, as it were, a mirror up to nature to really point out in his work and in his art how we are in a moment of dysfunction and where our dysfunction comes from. As an actor, I'm a student of human behavior. He, as a writer, is also a student of human behavior, and he's able to document that in his scripts. I mean, and that's what art is about. That's what I try to capture in the book. My mantra, what art is to the community, thoughts are to the individual. When you lie awake at night and toss and turn and reflect on who you are, who you hope to be, your strengths, your weaknesses, where you failed, where your triumphs are, where you're going, what those thoughts are to the individual, art as a community, when we sit in a darkened hall like this, is the forum where we reflect on who we are as a community, as a society. Where have we failed? Where have we triumphed? Where do we want to go? What are our values? And declare them and then act on them. This is the forum in art where we do that. What thoughts are to the individual, art is for the community as a whole to reflect on who they are, declare what their values are, and then act on them. And art can be in all different disciplines, in politics, in science, in law, where you have the communion of the technical proficiency and understanding and scientific theorem of what we're doing with the individuality and the creativity and expressive thought. It's really an American aesthetic. It's the thing that actually makes America unique. The fact that you can be expressive and individual within form, freedom within form, you know, going all the way back to what jazz and blues is all about. It is literally the American aesthetic on display. You know, Africans who take that African six of and heard the umpapa of their captors, umpapa, umpapa of Europe, and put it together and went bump, jazz that you just heard. Literally finding their own creative freedom. Finding their own creative freedom before they found their physical freedom. And so then art for them became insurrection, revolt, rebellion, to find their true selves. And that's the forum and the importance of art. And that's what I found or was reminded of when I went back home to New Orleans, is that that's the legacy of New Orleans going all the way back to the creation of jazz, that in that forum of art, art was not just a piece of entertainment. It was literally the place where you found resilience, revolt, resurrection, revelation, every day in New Orleans. And we live our culture more than any other place that I know of.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that also David finds in his writing. When he can go to a place and identify how a people intersect with life, and that intersection is culture. That intersection is culture, and how people, the small things, all the pieces fit, all the pieces matter. How they come together and something ordinary becomes extraordinary because people are dealing with their culture and how they deal with life itself, because that is going to be the most important thing that we do. And that's the forum of art. That's the role of art in our lives.
You're listening to actor and producer Wendell Pierce, whose new memoir is The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Whether the culture is inner city Baltimore or the culture is post-Katrina New Orleans. And
yes.
He's also talking about, at least in The Wire, how, bringing it down a little bit, how individuals lose themselves in institutions.
Absolutely. That's... Individuals lose themselves in institutions, how institutions cause people to go to a place of moral ambiguity. So you saw it, whether it was slinging in a street drug gang or in the police department itself or in the political arena within our schools. I think the fourth year of The Wire was the most extraordinary masterpiece. We literally saw where we lose our kids. And what's so amazing to me is how we forget their kids. And then it's almost as if we blame them. Well, they need to act better. They need to behave better. They have a responsibility to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. I'm like, hold it. We're the adults.
Right.
It's our responsibility to give them that, to make them behave better, to give them a viewpoint, to give them an opportunity. You know? And so, you know, and I mean, we see it all the time.
I was reminded of that last night preparing for this interview. I watched the episode where the kids in the neighborhood peed in the balloons.
And yeah, yes.
And I thought, yeah, they're kids.
I mean, and who hasn't peed in a balloon? Interesting thing about that season, that was the season I almost quit The Wire.
Really?
I almost quit The Wire at the end of, we would always shoot the season and then it would come on the air. We would be home. And we shot the fourth season. I didn't have much to do with the kids, and this wonderful young lady came up to me and, oh, Mr. Pierce, I was in the show this year, at the wrap party. And I really wanted to meet you. I didn't get a chance to work with you much or whatever, but I just graduated this year, and I'm going to Brown. And I'm like, wow, you're fantastic. I know I look younger than I am, so I was one of the kids in the middle school. And I said, who were you? And she said, Zenobia. And I said, Zenobia? Zenobia is the girl who's wild and out, just can't control herself in class and slices another girl's face. And she said, oh, yeah, that was my character. And then I said, but wait a minute. She was like an honor roll student and going to Brown. And then I said, wait, we should be telling your story. Mm-hmm. We should be telling your story. And I really got home and I was so upset about that. I was like, I said, I don't think I'm going to go back next year. And then it came on, I thought we were part of the problem. We've had that criticism before, so I thought maybe we are part of the problem. And then I saw the season, and I realized that the violence, the dysfunction, it wasn't arbitrary. It wasn't sensationalism. That people would never be able to pass some kids standing on the corner in some white T-shirts slinging and not see their humanity, because we were showing their humanity on the show. We were showing how they were really kids trying to put on a front, how these four little boys who were featured in that fourth year, how we lost two and saved two. Mm-hmm. We saw where we failed them, where the safety net, the social safety net, did not protect them. And we have a responsibility as adults to protect them, as a society, to declare that those are our values and that we're going to do something about it.
Yeah.
And so when I realized that the show was not sensationalizing it, but was shedding light on it and actually illuminating it in a way that I had never seen on television or in film or, you know, before, a real examination of the dysfunction of our schools and how we have failed our kids, that was the thing that allowed me to go back to The Wire for the last season.
Oh, and thank goodness you did. So, want to move on. Is it true that the actors never knew what was coming? Like, you didn't read ahead?
David, this is where we disagree. David has a belief that actors should know what's coming up in a series because they're going to start, it's going to influence what they're doing now. Like, ooh, I know in two episodes I'm going to have this great scene, you know, in a barbershop, you know. So, every time you mention barbershop in this scene, yeah, I might go to the barbershop. He feels though actors are always going to tip the hand, you know. So
right.
I'm like, we're professionals. We can not do that. But do I have a scene in the barbershop? And so he would never tell us. And there was this one scene that I was frustrated. This one particular season, and I was chasing a gun. And every episode, it was just like, just chasing this gun. And I just said, I don't know what's going on with this. I'm chasing the gun. Yeah, chasing the gun, chasing the gun. And I'm doing all of this research, and I'm going out, and I'm like, you know, and there's so many opportunities. And I was kind of bitching and complaining about what all the opportunities of developing Bonk's character, like an actor will do. You know, well, you could do this and this with the character. And I was talking about how frustrating it was with this other actor, and I was like, man, you know, and there's so much stuff that I want to talk about, like all of these African-American policemen that I met who became officers because they knew the crime in their community didn't reflect who their community was. You know, it was 1%, 99% of the people were just good, hardworking Mr. Joes and Miss Anns who go out every day and try to make a better way. And that's why they became a police officer, because they didn't feel as though the crime that was inundating their neighborhood was a reflection of the people that were there, and they wanted to stop that. The good people who were there who were disproportionately being affected by the crime, and they wanted to stop that. That's why most black men and women that I met became police officers. And I said, you know, they know the criminals. They went to school with them and all of that. And it made me think about my girlfriend's father, who told me a story. How in 1930s Oklahoma, in segregated America, they knew, they had such a sense of community in the black community, that if somebody was on track, they wouldn't let them get off track. And he was one of them. They knew his father was a principal, and they didn't want him to go off. They called him schoolboy. Mm. One time he would be in a party, all these thugs, even the thugs, would know, oh, no, schoolboy, you don't belong here. You going somewhere. We're going to protect you. The community had a sense of what was going to happen, right and wrong. And as I'm telling this story and complaining, George Pelicanos is behind me, and he goes, Wendell, you're chasing the gun because you're going to meet Omar. And I was just listening to you. And I'm writing that episode.
All right.
Can I use some of that research that you're talking about?
All right.
And I said, yes. And so that was the scene that you saw.
Wow.
Dr. George Moreland.
Yeah.
It was his story of how when he was growing up in the 30s and 40s in Oklahoma, they called him schoolboy and said, no, doc, you don't belong here. You know, we're going to make sure you get out of here. Even the thugs had a sense of community.
Yeah.
And that was the thing between that and the officers, African-American officers who joined the force because that didn't reflect their community. That was what we tried to capture in the relationship that they developed between Omar and Bunk.
Yeah.
Right? We went to Edmondson, the same schools. We are from the same community, so no more bodies. No more bodies. And when I saw the uprising in Baltimore last year, the thing that upset me the most was the fact that I wanted those police officers to admit it, mea culpa. Every cop in the country knows what a riot is. Yeah. You cuff a guy behind his back, you hit the gas, And when you get to the corner, you hit the brakes, he goes forward and busts his head, right? We all know it. Every cop, not one cop in America said, hey, listen, it's wrong, mea culpa. It's a cultural thing that we do. We need to stop it. That probably is what happened to Mr. Gray in that van, and it broke his neck, you know? Mm. And so when you look at the movement of, and are we going to sit here and not believe our lying eyes as we now have video evidence of what we thought was just, oh, yeah, black men complaining about how they intersect with police officers. When I walk out of here, I put my, like I say, I put my wallet on the dash whenever I'm stopped by a police officer because this is the most violent act they can see if I reach for my wallet. So I would hope that those men that I have such admiration for would be so offended by not only the criminality that they see, but the criminality that they see by someone who would actually dare to wear the badge that they honor, that they have respect for. And I said all of that to say something about the scene, but I got caught up.
And I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did, because all of this work has
resonance. It's an examination of the world, and it's, you know, it was interesting last summer, this summer, they called us. Everyone reached out, the media, City Hall, the government, reached out to the people that created The Wire. Said, we want to have some discussions about this.
Yeah.
Right? We want you to get involved. I said, we've been talking about this for 5 years. Okay. We've been showing you the variables that are in this cauldron that's been boiling, that you now see boiling over. But I can say here tonight that I am now a part of an effort. Talk is cheap. But now I'm now a part of an effort of a social investment group that we are actually going to pool the resources and actually start to go into the communities of West Baltimore where you see those rows of empty row houses, take training with electricians and carpenters and all, and take those young men who don't have an opportunity, train them up with the SEIU 1199, and get them in there. And we are going to renovate, rebuild, and put those houses back into the market.
So. All right. And you're also involved and have been involved in efforts to bring back New Orleans, but Katrina hit during the Wire, and Pontchartrain Park, where you grew up, was one of the most severely affected. In fact, your parents went to Baton Rouge. They got out, thank God.
Yeah, I was there. I got my parents out. I had come home for a vacation that Saturday and said, what's going on? All these people, they said, the hurricane is coming. I'm like, the one in Florida? They said, yeah, it took a left. It's coming this way. And I told my parents, well, if they make it mandatory evacuation, we'll leave. Because I wanted to party. it was my vacation, a week in New Orleans before I go to Baltimore and go start work. And I went out that night, and that Sunday morning, they said, a mandatory evacuation, which had never happened in New Orleans. And so I said, okay, let's get out of here. I had a hangover. And we were packing the car, and my nieces were in from New York, and my father had broken his leg at the time, and so we put them all in the car, and it's taking forever to pack. I'm like, it's just going to be 2 days. Mm-hmm. Right? So, listen, you guys go. I'm going to stay. And I took a nap. I went to sleep. Now, the good Lord takes care of fools and babies, and I ain't no baby. So I was definitely a fool and woke up, and thankfully, they were still packing the car. And I said, all right, I'll go with you. And that's how I left. And Pontchartrain Park was in 20 feet of water for 3 weeks.
Yeah. And in the book, there's a lot of detail about what happened to your neighborhood, but after Katrina, you played Vladimir in Waiting for Godot.
Yes.
In a production in Harlem that Christopher McElroy did, and he set it in a waterlogged city. And this is where all this stuff starts coming together.
He saw a really
profound way.
He saw a picture of two men on a raft in the water of New Orleans looking up. I think they saw a helicopter or something. And he said he saw that image, and it was Vladimir and Estragon from Waiting for Godot. Two men in a void an absolute nothingness, without any direction, without any hope, not knowing who they were, where they came from, where they were going, looking for something outside of themselves, this entity of Godot. Who is Godot? What is Godot? We are waiting for Godot. And here he decided to do a play and not change anything about it. Have a rooftop coming out of 15,000 gallons of water on the stage. And we did the play, and it immediately resonated as being New Orleans. Paul Chan, a visual artist, saw the Lower Ninth Ward on a visit to New Orleans, and he said it reminded him of every production of Waiting for Godot he had ever seen, because it was just miles and miles of destruction and nothing there. And he reached out to the Classical Theater of Harlem, where we had done the play, and said, let's do it in New Orleans. And that's when I said, I'm from New Orleans, so I definitely want to do it there. I wanted to have a response. I wanted to do something, and I am an artist first. So let that art be what my response is going to be. I knew that years from now someone was going to say, what did you do? And I wanted to have something to say that I did. And so it was in that play that I had one of the most profound and cathartic moments of my life, because it was there that all these men and women from all walks of life, rich and poor, white and black, lawyers and longshoremen and shopkeepers and teachers and housewives and people from all walks of life gathered as New Orleanians in this darkened neighborhood, destroyed, to see this play. And there was a moment of epiphany and of catharsis that I'll never forget. And it was the thing that kind of was the catalyst for me for the next 10 years. And I decided to write this snapshot because of that moment. And this is the story of my homecoming. This is the story of my part in the pilgrimage of my family and my people out of exile. It is a story of faith, hope, and love. And it is a story that begins with a slave child waving goodbye to his family on the banks of the river as the boat carried him south into an abyss of suffering. That I am here to tell the tale at all means it is not a tragedy. It means that as long as we draw breath, tragedy, even a tragedy as overwhelming as a hurricane that nearly destroyed a city, does not have to destroy, have the last word. Like the poet W.H. Auden says, we stagger onward, rejoicing. Those car lights I saw that night on the Claiborne Avenue Bridge belonged to New Orleanians who were also a part of the pilgrimage. I did not know it then, and they didn't either, but I am certain of it now. Those fellow pilgrims were headed into the Lower Ninth Ward to affirm by their presence that the power of art, the bonds of the beloved community, and the perseverance of the human spirit are all lights that the darkness cannot overcome. In American culture, we have turned away from an awareness of the prophetic power of art, of its role as a means of revealing the hidden order beneath everydayness and its power to transform us and the world. Art tells us who we are, and it tells us who we must become. Art doesn't give us life's answers as much as it empowers us to live life's questions. Art, like religion, is how the eternal and the ideal enters time and becomes real. In turn, it is how we mortals experience, if only for a moment, immortality. Art is how we humans individually and collectively impress our seal on the wax. It is how we charge ordinary matter, wood, paint, stone, a word, a voice, a note, a gesture, with life and spirit and harmony. Art is the most serious thing we can do, because when making it, we humans, forged in the image of God, are most like our Creator. We tend to forget that. This production of Godot in that weary time, in that storm-battered place, helped me remember. And I was far from the only one.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features actor and producer Wendell Pierce, whose new memoir is The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Early in the play's first act, Vladimir hears a voice and thinks it might signal Godot's approach. "Pah," snorts Estragon dismissively. The wind in the reeds. We would be wrong to dismiss that sound. Man is only a reed, said the French philosopher Blaise Pascal, but he is a thinking reed. When the winds of adversity blow hard against him, the sound they make as they pass over his contours may be mere noise, or they may be something like the music of teenage Sidney Bechet, grandson of a slave, made when he blew across his clarinet's reed and standing on the back of a New Orleans furniture truck next to a horn-playing juvenile delinquent named Louis Armstrong, helped create jazz. I learned from the late Albert Murray, the great Harlem connoisseur of black music, that art is the way individuals and cultures react aesthetically to their experiences in life. Jazz and the blues, the most American of all musical forms, is the sound made by history's savage gales blowing hard on African people in the diaspora. The storm-tossed reeds may be humble, but the reeds are thinking. The reeds are feeling, and the reeds are resilient. The reeds sing a song of triumph. The harder the wind blows, the stronger our spirit, the purer our art, and the greater our victory. The wind in the reeds.
Yeah. So there's a beautiful description in the book of the opening night of Godot in the lower Ninth Ward.
Yes.
And you really have to read this to appreciate that. But there you are in this place that has been so devastated with a play that many people think of as abstract.
Yes.
And difficult, and was written about Nazi-occupied
yes.
Paris,
That's
yet... The parallels are so strong.
That's the thing that makes it such a classic play. It resonated to people there because it was... people saw themselves. People, when you go to the movies, when you see a play, when you hear music, you reflect on it because it's some reflection of yourself that you see. You see your humanity in it. And what makes a play like Waiting for Godot so classic and so human is the fact that it speaks to people across time, across space. It connects to that humanity in us that was there before we existed and will outlast us and outlive us. It's the thing that makes us understand that we can see and read works by Shakespeare, and it still speaks to us today, that this Irish immigré in Paris under Nazi occupation, speaking of his restriction and all of the desolation and hopelessness that he felt there, he writes Waiting for Godot, and it becomes a classic because it years later, it speaks in the 80s to the people of Sarajevo when Susan Sontag did a production of it in the midst of the Balkan War, violence and destruction and absolute hopelessness. And there, in the midst of the lower Ninth Ward, on hallowed ground, where so many people had died, where so many people had died through no fault of their own, New Orleanians came to see this abstract, surreal play, and it spoke to them because it was so human and so real. And that cathartic moment where I stopped and said, at this place, in this moment of time, all mankind is us. Let us do something while we have the chance before it's too late. It was almost as if I just stepped out of character and I was standing amongst family, the family of New Orleanians who had lost everything, and said, listen, we owe it to the people who had died on this hallowed ground to rebuild our lives, to rebuild our communities, and rebuild ourselves. And you could not get a more perfect demonstration of the power of art and the role of art, because that was the thing that led us to an awakening of saying, I have to come back for myself personally. And that led me to go back to Pontchartrain Park and organize and put out a call to action where we put together our own community development corporation. So we got the properties that were sold back to government so that we can rebuild solar and geothermal homes, and by brick, block by block, house by house, we have built 40 today, and our neighborhood is back.
Yeah.
Right? It was a call to action.
Yeah.
But that expression of culture motivating you and moving you to action, declaring your values and moving you to action, was always a part of New Orleans. You heard the brass band there.
Yeah.
The second line in New Orleans, you can see it anywhere in the world. You recognize it as something from our culture. But it came out of a community and a time when, as black folks in segregation, you couldn't get burial plots, you couldn't get health care, you couldn't get access to insurance. And so we pooled our money into social aid and pleasure clubs. You understand the pleasure part because you heard it tonight. Right? But social aid, people forget about that. A social safety net, a benevolent society. This JCC understands what that is about.
Oh, thank you.
That you actually use your community, and it was out of the culture. So if your mama takes sick, we're going to take care of you and your family. If your daddy died, we're going to send him off nice. It was practical benevolence in the form of culture. We're very practical people. If you ever been to New Orleans in August, you understand why we have umbrellas and handkerchiefs in the second line, because it's hot. That is the prophetic power of culture and art. It was always a part. Those Africans who created jazz. I was inspired to be an actor because of the Free Southern Theater,
yeah,
a theater company that went around during the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement, and did plays all over the South under the threat of violence. They wouldn't come out for a curtain call, so the Klan wouldn't get them. They would be in the car and head back to New Orleans. But I couldn't even see them, but I couldn't wait till my parents would come back and tell me about the plays. I knew, oh man, one day it inspired me to be an actor. So my art was never just trivial.
Right.
It was practical. It was revolutionary. It was reformative. It was insurrection. It was revelation.
There's such a beautiful symmetry to all of this, because what you're talking about, the power of art, is something that David Simon then did with Tremé post-Katrina,
yes,
and communicated something really important about the culture and about the aftermath of the storm on a really deep level. And in fact, you've called Tremé, which he wrote with you in mind, divine intervention, because it allowed you professionally to come back to New Orleans to spend, yes, your mother's last years,
yes,
with her. So it was a very personal project.
Tremé was not a job. It was not a TV show. It was, like you said, divine intervention for me. It was one of the most important things that ever happened to me in my life. It was like group therapy. All around New Orleans, you would see people get together for watch parties, and they would look at the show, which was always a couple of years lag behind where we were at the time, so they can actually get perspective on, maybe I'm not as down as I thought I was. Maybe I'm a little further along, where people can have an epiphany about their own journey. I know one friend of mine said he never cried. He lost everything. He had never cried until he saw a scene in Tremé where Chief Lambrou goes into his house. And talk about sense memory. He heard the squishing of the mud under his feet as he walked through his living room, and he lost it. He said that sound was the most horrifying sound that he remembered. And he said, here it is, you know, 2 years after the fact, and this is the first time I cried. I didn't know I was holding so much in.
Mm-hmm.
He said, now I feel free to go on. And it was that sort of impact that I think Tremé had. And I think we've created this little cultural document that years from now, someone can pull out and say, this is where we were at the time And it gives you perspective. This is how far we've come. Like you said, it also allowed me to be home for the last 4 years of my mother's life. Mm-hmm. And to know that everything they gave me, my parents, that I was able to make sure to get them back in that little house in Pontchartrain Park.
And you built a house, your own house there,
yes,
as well. So
I couldn't ask people to come back if to a disaster zone if I didn't have some skin in the game, as they say. So as a developer, I bought the first house that we built. And so I live in Pontchartrain Park. I said, I will buy a house here also, because I put the call out to action to people of my generation who had learned so much and have been given so much from my parents' generation, that Moses generation passing on a legacy to that Joshua generation, that I owed it to them. It would have been blasphemous for us to let the neighborhood go after all they had gone through to build it up. It was one of the triumphs of the civil rights movement, and we owed it to them to make sure that we rebuilt it. And so those 4 years of doing Treme allowed me to come back home. And also was an awakening to not only the power of art, the call to action that culture can be, how culture is in New Orleans, but it also showed me the legacy of my family, mm-hmm. that this was not something new, that I had been given this resilience and this journey and this blueprint for everything that they had gone through. And so it made me realize that going back for generations, I had been given the tools and the equipment and the preparation for moments just like that, mm-hmm. to be an artist and to be the man that I needed to be to rebuild, to service that call. And if you would indulge me for a moment, I would like to read this for family that I have here in San Francisco that's here. So this is for you, family. Down the bayou at the source, we know who we are by the stories we tell about ourselves and the world. We know who we are through the family and community of whose stories we are a part. We make our stories, and our stories make us. I'm not sure the stories of my family are art, exactly. After all, they came down to me not as objects to be admired for their beauty. Then again, they contain so much truth and goodness that they cannot help but being beautiful as well. Their trials, their triumphs, the virtues that gave them the strength to overcome, all of these things live in the stories my family shares as an inheritance that grows as we invest in each successive generation. I draw creative strength from my roots buried deep in South Louisiana. Until the storm, I did not appreciate how much those roots were, the veins connecting my heart to the body of historical experience that gave birth to the man I am today, and the man and the artist I am becoming every day. Here are some of the stories that made me. Sometime in the 1850s, nobody can say exactly when, on the banks of Kentucky River, a boy named Ira Steele rested in the basket of his slave mother's arms as she said goodbye to their family and sailed away. One white man had sold mother and child to another white man, as the child's father, brothers, sisters stood on the water's edge in tears. 500 miles downriver, the passage of the mother and her child ended on a sugarcane plantation near Bertramville and Assumption Parish, a moist and fertile patch of land between the Mississippi River and Bayou Lafourche. The master forced his name on the mother and child, Harris, and that is how my family came to South Louisiana. Years later, after emancipation in 1865, Ira Steele would tell his children that his earliest memories are of his mother teaching him to say his prayers at night and telling him when freedom comes, as it surely would, to go on a quest. You are not a Harris. You are a Christoph, she would say. If you ever get free, go back to Kentucky and look for your family, the Christophs. He never did. The story of Ira Steele's descendants is a story of a parade through American history, sometimes a mournful dirge, sometimes a raucous stomp. From being symbolically owned by the bayou to owning a piece of it. That is, from being treated as no more important than the land they worked for the white man as enslaved exiles, to becoming masters of themselves and that land, which would become, in the fullest sense of the word, home. Why am I telling you this? Because I would not be the man I am if my ancestors had not been the men and women they were. In Southern culture, family and land are everything, especially to African Americans, whose families were broken by slavery and in liberty, left with little or nothing. In my clan, the ancestors live on through the stories we tell ourselves and our children, and in the family farm on Bayou Lafourche. My cousin Nicole, the family historian, reminds us older folks that we have a responsibility to tell these family stories to the younger generation. Family can easily fall apart. You can't take it for granted. My mother and father showed me the value of family and why it's worth fighting for. So whenever I wonder why I'm hanging on to these people who are becoming strangers to me, I take a step back. And I think about our shared history. If we forget our stories, we will forget who we are, and we will forget who we must be to one another. The family is our strength. My personal triumphs are not mine alone. They represent the victory of all my forebears. You trace a line from the Hollywood sound stages where I work to the sugarcane fields of Louisiana's river parishes. These stories, stories of ancestors I never knew, are my story too. Not only because they form the moral imaginations of those who formed me, but also became these tales from my family's oral tradition. Tell me who I am.
Thanks to you all for being here tonight. Most of all, Wendell Pierce.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was actor and producer Wendell Pierce, whose new memoir is The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.